If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Fiona Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. Good to have you back.
What news from while I was gone?
Well, when you were gone, we decided to change the format completely. So we're not going to bother with books anymore.
Is it all singing, all dancing?
It's mostly celebrity, very, very short celebrity interviews and sport we thought we'd go for.
sounds perfect. Sounds ideal.
Good. Yeah.
So I was in Cornwall, not at the G7 event.
I thought you'd secretly gone as part of G7.
Weirdly, I mean, I wasn't invited. See you popping up. I wasn't invited, which is a shame because I mean, I have loads of ideas. but no, I wasn't invited. I was in Cornwall. I was mooching around. I went to an independent bookshop, which is on theme given this week being Indie Bookshop Week, and we will talk all about that later in the show. But the weather has been warmish and quite wet. So I'm wondering whether your allotment has gone bananas. Have you even grown bananas, perhaps?
No. The danger is, it's all very well. I mean, I'm glad about the rain. But I tell you who else is glad about the rain, and that's slugs and snails.
Oh, of course.
And blighters. I know, exactly, the blighters. And the point is that we've just recently put in a load of tender young plants.
Oh, dear.
So I'm just... my fingers are crossed, basically.
It's that's a harsh, what's harsh lesson in life.
Yeah, that's nature.
Oh, dear. Well, in the meantime, while I was gone, I believe you've had lots of submissions from people wanting to bang the drum for their favourite independent bookshops. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, we've got lots and lots of names to... of bookshops to mention. And I'm sure we're just scratching the surface. It's brilliant.
Well, great. Well, because as I said, this week is the week, Independent Bookshop Week. Coming up later in the show, we will share as many of those nominations as we can. We'll also pick through this year's Summer Book Special, in which writers, including Joyce Carol Oates and Andrew Motion, tell us what they are reading or planning to read over these at least traditionally drier, hotter months. But first, Lucy, over to you for our first item.
This week, we're looking at tech, artificial intelligence, and the future of work. Opinion within the AI community itself is divided as to how advanced AIs or robots will be and when, and whether they will be able to do what humans do, maybe even better or just differently. But everyone does seem to agree that the way we work will change, and hence our economic views, as well as our social, ethical, and philosophical ones, will have to change in turn. We have a piece this week co-authored by Jane Humphreys, Professor of Economic History at LSE, and Benjamin Schneider, a DPhil candidate at Oxford. Jane can't join us today, but we're happy to say that Ben can, and he's here to talk these issues through with us. Ben Schneider, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you say in your piece that there have been these dire predictions of AI taking over the world and also the world of work for decades. But since the publication of this one particular book in 2014, those predictions have been more frequent. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and its central idea?
Sure. So this book is The Second Machine Age by Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, so two researchers from MIT. And the basic contention of the book was... there was then, and has since the book was published, been a lot of progress on artificial intelligence, as you mentioned, and that essentially what this is likely to lead to is a world that is relatively good for people with what economists call high skills or high levels of education, but the people with what they refer to as ordinary skills are likely to lose out. So the traditional way that economists tend to think about this is people in many sorts of routine jobs are likely to suffer from AI. There's research that shows that large swathes of the population in rich countries, as well as developing countries, are in those sort of routine jobs, and their work could be threatened by this new technology.
Right, and so people have taken that idea on board, haven't they? And this has it's led theorists on the left and the right. I was struck by you saying this. Unusually, they're both. Some of them are proposing a system where everyone gets a universal basic income, a UBI, though obviously they have different views on public spending within that proposition. How and why do they think that might work?
The basic idea of universal basic income, to the extent that it's motivated by automation and technological change, is on the left, it's broadly seen as an opportunity to sort of free people from a compulsion for needing to have to go to work or to be forced into low quality jobs, precarious work, and so on. On the right, what it tends to be seen as, especially sort of the libertarian and technologist right, is this is a way of ensuring that people can continue to maintain a decent standard of living so that we can also embrace the new technologies that might be replacing jobs. So you can have a world in which, yes, we have lots of automation and there are both sort of macroeconomic and human or quality of life living standards benefits from that. But it's essentially a political trade-off whereby you then ensure that a whole bunch of people don't say, well, we need to sort of fight against this technological change because it's going to replace our incomes. So you can sort of see there that they're both very, obviously very different motivations in the world that you would end up with on the other end of that, if it were to come into practice in either case, is also very different.
As you say, they're very different positions, but they're both positing it as a way of dealing with the AI and technology as a sort of possible solution to what might happen, I guess.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there is also at the same time a strand that's more on the left of saying this is a way, yes, in which we can accommodate a world in which there's lots of technological change, but also that the point that I mentioned before about fundamentally it gives workers more bargaining power is another element on the left where, you know, it's beneficial because it will give workers the opportunity to turn down work that they don't want to do.
Is there any, I mean, I suspect the answer is no, but is there any consensus as to how governments might determine when it's the time to introduce these sorts of policies? I mean, is it to do with the percentage of people affected, the sorts of sectors feeling it most, the total value of income lost? Is there a general sense of that?
Not at this point. I mean, most of the academic research and sort of policy research that's been done on UBI is largely about determining what are the effects on sort of human well-being, and importantly for economists, whether it has an impact on incentives to work. So economists and one of the authors that we'll talk about is quite concerned about basic income making people think, I no longer need to have an occupation because the government is giving me this constant stipend. Therefore, I will withdraw from the labor force. And there are arguments also related to that that are not purely economic, but about the, you know, social value and sort of feelings of well-being that one gets from achieving things in a job. So there's a whole bunch of sort of arguments about that. But at this point, there hasn't really been a consensus on which triggers would be appropriate.
Let's move on to the books that you've reviewed for us, two rather different books, aren't they? Why don't you tell us about the first one, which is by Roger Bootle, who is a well-known and respected economist, but not an AI specialist. How does he present this case?
So, as you say, yeah, Bootle is, I think it's fair to say, center-right economist, occasionally writes for the Daily Telegraph. He's been known, for example, for predicting the UK's exit from the ERM in 1992. But in this book, he admits at the start that he's sort of going into territory that he is kind of less familiar with. And a significant part of the book is describing the natures of some of the potentials of automation technology, but also he spends a lot of time talking about the limitations and the pitfalls, the things that robots are not yet able to do and may in fact never be able to do. So I think that really informs a lot of his more skeptical approach compared to the automation theorists who are saying the power of AI with pattern recognition will wipe aside a lot of jobs. He's much more skeptical about that. And that sort of in part probably informs his more small c conservative sense of the policies that would be appropriate for it. So basically he suggests we'll sort of pivot towards a world in which many people have more leisure time and have more, let's say, passion projects and spend less time in formal employment. Basically.
And does he, and his economic approach to that is also quite a traditional one, isn't it?
So one concern about having a huge wave of automation is there's potentially a big impact on demand. So once you basically replace a whole bunch of people with robots, where is the demand for purchasing services and goods going to come from? Boodle is skeptical that it's going to happen, but he says if it does happen, we can think of maybe existing approaches in the policy toolkit. Government can step in and increase demand, and that'll raise the demand for labor, and you'll sort of pull people out of what would have been unemployment as a result of automation. You know, broadly, when we look at a lot of the books that have been written in this area, people tend to, both sort of academic researchers and also technologists tend to take a perspective of either I'm going to sort of take something off the shelf, and that's Boodle's approach, sort of what do we know, what is macroeconomics given to us as policy solutions, what do we know from labor economics of ways in which it's possible to train people and place people back into jobs, and then sort of apply those to the present day. And then there's another set of approaches. And the second book that we talk about in the article is more along the lines of the second one, which is we're going to sort of try and imagine a world in which we don't think about just those off-the-shelf approaches to potential problems of automation, but we're going to imagine a different endpoint, basically.
Mm. So this second book is by Aaron Benanav, isn't it? And as you say, it's got a less traditional outlook. It's basically, I suppose, I mean, it's some of them are facing backwards and some of them are facing forwards, and there's different problems. The problem with facing forwards is that even the people working at the cutting edge of AI at the minute, they're not really agreeing on what AI will be able to do, are they? But this book suggests some pretty radical restructuring, doesn't it? What do you think of his analysis?
Right. So maybe just to frame it a little bit, Benanav is a historian of basically labor and unemployment. And his contention here, this it's a very, slim book that's based off of a couple of articles that were published in the New Left Review a few years ago. He essentially challenges the basic premise of the automation theorists or technologists, which I mentioned before, is essentially you have either happening right now, it's already happening, or coming down the pipe is a huge amount of automation that will is replacing or will in the future replace large swathes of jobs. He says just this is not happening right now, and we can see this because productivity of labor has not been rising as quickly as it would need to be to explain the phenomena that we can see in the economy. And this is broadly accepted across economics in terms of those labor productivity statistics. After the Second World War, there was a period of about 30 years in Western Europe, to some extent also in Eastern Europe and the United States, where there was, and Japan as well, where there's high labor productivity growth. So this is sometimes referred to as the golden age of capitalism. And then since about the 1970s, growth has been much slower of labor productivity. Benanav says, you know, if there's all this technology that's coming in and replacing workers right now, and if that were the explanation for why unemployment is higher than it was in that post-war period, that doesn't fit because productivity isn't rising enough to be essentially dispensing with the need for those workers. So instead, what he argues is going on is that there's a relationship between output growth, so all the stuff that is made or services provided in the economy, and productivity growth. So the technologists are saying there's this huge spurt of productivity growth. You don't need as many workers to make the same amount of stuff or a slightly increasing amount of stuff. And that's why demand for labor is low. That is why underemployment is higher. More people are working on precarious or short hours contracts. Benanov says that's not the explanation because labor productivity isn't high enough to explain that relationship. Instead, output growth is too low. This is because we are not demanding and producing as much stuff, and the demand for labor is the fundamental problem.
Does he think that the boom in the golden age was because there was this rise of manufacturing? And that's not happening anymore, and nothing else has replaced it. Automation is not replacing it either. It's not like for like.
Right, exactly. So he says the growth engine of capitalism is the manufacturing sector, what we sometimes call the secondary sector. So where you take stuff and turn it into other stuff. There are a couple of reasons for this, but one of them is that this is a part of the economy where it is relatively easy to achieve productivity growth. So you can, in the Industrial Revolution, you can create a factory, put a bunch of machines in the factory, and you have rapidly increased productivity through a combination of the machines, the power, and labor discipline. And then that sort of innovation can be rolled out across different sectors of the economy. When you have an economy that has pivoted, as rich countries have, towards the service sector, it's much harder to do those sorts of productivity enhancing or to take up those sorts of productivity enhancing innovations. So in the period after the Second World War, as you suggest in the question, you do have a lot of this investment in new factories. A lot of it's happening in Europe. So rebuilding in continental Europe, especially, you have lots of investment in capital stock, as economists call it, new factories and machinery. That sort of burns itself out in overcapacity. Then there's also competition coming in from developing countries. So manufacturing becomes essentially unprofitable because there's overcapacity and there's not continued investment in that part of the economy. As workers then shift out of manufacturing, it's harder for society to achieve the same rates of productivity growth in the service sector. So it's harder to industrialize, say, making a cup of coffee for you in the morning than it was to industrialize and achieve high rates of productivity growth in car manufacturing, because it's not sort of standardized in the same way, basically.
Yeah, so it's hard. It's basically, yes, it's harder to get an AI to, as you say, make you a cup of coffee and have a little chat with you in the morning. Though, I mean, you know, who knows, that might be possible. There's also a theory, isn't there, that says that as new technologies develop, new jobs will develop, i.e. that the job of a coder or a programmer or a web developer didn't exist, you know, let's say 20 years ago, and now there's lots of them, but that's not proven yet, is it? That's the trouble.
This kind of takes us to the heart of a lot of the debates, or a lot of the parts of this debate that try and look at history to explain or predict what's going to happen, what's happening now, what's going to happen in the future. We have had instances of disruptive innovation in the past. Hundreds of thousands of workers in Britain were displaced by different technologies during the Industrial Revolution. But then, eventually, there were new jobs, and or there were parts of the economy that grew because of people who remained employed were employed on higher wages and had more purchasing power. So the sort of the structure of the economy shifted. And in the past, we've always managed to basically create enough jobs to employ the people who lost out. That generally has worked, but the time horizon could be such that maybe it's 30 or 40 years before we get back to the same level of aggregate employment. And what happens to the people? What happens to the places where those lost jobs were concentrated?
And I suppose as well, another thing that has changed, you know, there may have been job creation, but one of the things that's changed certainly since the post-Second World War period that you were describing earlier is the sort of place of power within that. It's concentration in ever fewer hands, right? So Ben and Nav warns that unless workers take power from the current owners of capital, in, you know, this new world that he imagines will be very unequal, the vast majority will be in secure work. I mean, that's quite a heavy caveat, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And part of, maybe I should just mention, I think I might have hinted at this before, but part of his case is essentially that, you know, in trying to explain contemporary levels of lack of labor demand, this shows up in different ways. It can show up as unemployment, but it can also show up as people being part-time for reasons outside their control, or low wages, or poor working conditions.
And the kind of 0 hours, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And instability, yeah.
Yes. And kind of as one explanation for that, in addition to the lack of labor demand that he talks about, is the weakness of organized labor unions. It vary in different countries to what extent this is an issue, but, you know, sort of for the last 30 to 40 years, in general, organized labor has become much weaker. And that is another factor that he argues is sort of playing into the story. But yeah, Thea, as you suggest, you know, what he is proposing, imagining here is effectively to say, we don't know what the potential of these technologies will be, but we should not think of a world in which we have to sort of travel through an automation pathway to reach a utopia. Instead, the world that he proposes doesn't require or requires very limited use of computer technology and so on. It doesn't need to be automated, but it's essentially a, how would be the right way to put this? Maybe sort of a global commune in which everyone does some amount of necessary labor, whether it's carrying labor, cleaning in your local community and so on. And then in return for that, everyone receives communistic way, sort of whatever they need to survive, and then can use the rest of their time as they see fit to pursue activities that they think contribute to their personal development and human dignity.
Yeah. So as you, I mean, I think as you say in the piece, that sounds great, but how do you get there?
Right.
What's the route by which you get there?
And Benanov is not explicit about it, but it's not terribly hard also to read between the lines of what he's saying. And there are a few points in the book where he says sort of something along the lines of power has to be taken away from, I forget the term that he uses, but it's essentially, he essentially means capitalists. Mm. I think asset owners is the phrase that he uses.
Right. So that's an awful lot to pack in. Do you know what I mean? That's in terms of a plan.
Yes.
If you go, okay, I think we'll do this and let's not rely too much on automation. Let's take power out of the hands of the capital owners. And then we'll all share, you know, I mean, that's.
Yeah. And then on Thursday, we'll.
Yeah. That's a big step there. Are you, I mean, in a way, both of the books sort of have a utopia in view, don't they? Bootle seems to be a sort of gradual progression that would be understandable throughout history, and Benanov's, as we said, rather different. Are you convinced by either of them?
I find Benanov's description of the present somewhat more convincing, but as we've just been discussing, I think his route into the future is, we might say, somewhat underdeveloped, or not fully dealing with the implications of how one would try to get there. I think in some ways, the story that Bootle tells is appealing for people who are slightly concerned about rapid and destructive social change. And there's certainly some elements in it, the sort of specific elements of, it's likely that jobs will shift more towards being more human-to-human, face-to-face interactions, because so far, we haven't developed any robots that can replicate the sort of value that one gets. And I suspect that many people have sort of been reminded of the value of it in the last year, of having an interaction with another human being face to face. So in that sense, the sort of description of the types of jobs that people are likely to have, what they're likely to look like, I think that's a fair description. But I think Bootle's skepticism about the potential for technology is, I would be very cautious about that. In part, this is because, as I've said, as an economic historian, there have been various times in the past where people have predicted what's going to happen in the future based on their knowledge of what has happened in the recent past and then been proved extremely wrong because events take a turn that they weren't predicting. I mean, maybe one of the most best known examples of this is Thomas Malthus, who says in the end of the 18th century, you know, we can't really increase the standard of living because it's a function of how much land you have. And that's happening right at the point in history in which there's an industrial revolution and then you have a transformation of the world where you can have both population growth and increasing standards of living. So I would be skeptical about the idea that the world in 50 years is going to look very similar, which is essentially what Bootle suggests, to the one that we have now. I think there are many avenues in which you can travel, and there's certainly scope for significant automation in many areas of the economy.
Well, we will have to ask you back in 50 years, and then we can work out what worked and what didn't.
I'd be delighted to come back then.
Brilliant. Ben Schneider, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Still to come on the show, what are some of our writers reading this summer? We'll find out. And as it's Indie Bookshop Week, which bookshops are you listeners flying flags for? And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast, alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition, should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we're joined by another TLSer, Alice Wadsworth, to wend our way through the results of this year's Summer Reading Symposium, let's catch up with the submissions for Most Treasured Independent Bookshop. Having launched the appeal a couple of weeks ago, I then scuttled off into the undergrowth. So, Lucy, it's on you to fill us all in, please.
Well, we've had lots of lovely suggestions. We got a tweet from Books in My Bag, who I think run Independent Bookshop Week. So we got a big hello back to them. And we got lots of recommendations, which reminds me what a wealth of independent bookshops we have and how lucky we are to have them. Mostly in the UK, though we do have a couple from further afield. So this is from, on Twitter, it's Mpush and Tabeni. And he says, my favourite indie bookshop is called The Book Lounge at Rowland Street in Cape Town. It's the place to go for new local continental international books, always the first to get new books. He said their online services are fantastic and deliver nationally with an efficient courier service in South Africa where we don't really have the benefits of Amazon. Also has an amazing podcast called A Reader's Community, and it's generally a wonderful place. So that's a good shout out, isn't it?
Yeah, and I should say, in fact, that I actually went there a few years ago.
Did you?
I did, when I was in Cape Town. I know, it's very surprising, isn't it?
Is it good?
I went there. It is, it's lovely. I mean, it's a very impressive looking building. You just see it and it's pink and white. It's got a kind of high ceilings and chandeliers once you get inside. And I remember it being pleasantly cool. For a start, because the ceiling fans, which was very welcome indeed. But yes, so I've been there, so I can second Mr. Tabini's recommendation there.
Well, that's brilliant. Icon Books, the publisher, sent us a list of lots of places that they like. And it would be nice if we could stop and talk about all of them, but there's too many. So I'm just going to kind of
reel them off.
I think. There's Dial Lane Books, which says, is Ipswich's only indie bookshop. Red Lion Books, which is in Colchester. S. Reed Books in the Lake District. Reed in Home Firth. Reed, I think there, that's the verb, i.e. come and read a book. Ebb and Flow Books, which is in Chorley. Book Corner HX, which means Halifax. I know this is in the Peace Hall.
Ah, so you know it from your days.
Yeah, I don't know that bookshop actually, but I know the Peace Hall very well. The Peace Hall's amazing. And they're clearly doing very well. Book Bar UK, which have got, so they're in London, and they want to bring people together through books, and they've got a thing they call Shelf Medicate, They do bespoke.
Well, they get some kind of prize for the name.
That's very good, isn't it? That's bespoke book prescriptions. They do that. Houseman's Books, Radical Booksellers in London, Pages, Cheshire Street, independent bookshop selling books by women, trans, gender diverse writers, sister shop to Pages of Hackney, Owl Bookshop in Kentish Town, Primrose Hill Bookshop, Category Is Books, which is an independent queer bookshop in Glasgow, Portal Bookshop, sci-fi, fantasy, LGBTQIA, that's in York. Porty Books, which is at the beach in Portobello, Edinburgh, which I love Portobello, that sounds brilliant. And Lighthouse Books, which is they call themselves Scotland's leading politics bookshop, also in Edinburgh. And I talked about Golden Hair Books, which is another one in Edinburgh.
And we've heard from them, haven't we?
Yeah, they said hi as well. So hello back to them.
Hello.
We also got some internal recommendations from TLS editors, which I promised I would mention. Our own George Berridge recommended Libraria, which is off Brick Lane, apparently. Burley Fisher Books on Kingsland Road, I think. The Winchester Antiquarian Bookshop. Leakey's in Inverness. I know Inverness a little bit, and I've never been to Leakey's, and I can't believe I've missed it because it's huge, apparently. Alexander Leisler, who came on a few weeks ago to talk about... do you remember what's the name of what you talked about?
Oh, hold on.
Floating Points. Floating
yes,
Points.
Yes, Floating Points.
Was the producer, and he did that beautiful album. So he's recommended Bookmongers in Brixton, City Books in Hove, and Pequod Books in Berlin. So just nipped outside the UK again there.
And did you see about Self-Made Hero? You know, the independent publisher... they specialise in graphic novels. Did you see they have this initiative? So they've launched their own challenge, which is a decidedly more challenging challenge than ours, I think. They're asking people to draw their favourite indie bookshop. And the idea is to draw it and post it on Twitter or Instagram, tagging the bookshop and adding at Self-Made Hero and at Books Are My Bag. So the winner's art will then be published in postcard form. They did this last year. And obviously it was such an enjoyable, such a popular thing that they've brought it back. The outcome, the winner will be announced at some point in the summer, but it just sounds great, doesn't it?
It does. It sounds brilliant. It's one of the things that really, really makes me wish I could draw.
Exactly. I think Mr. Ntabeni should have a go at drawing the book lounge, seeing as I know it to be such an impressive looking place. So there's a challenge on the challenge. Now, in a rare instance of synergy on this podcast, now that we've heard about all these wonderful bookshops, we're going to talk about some books that you might want to purchase from them or from other bookshops. Every year, we ask a selection of our writers to tell us what they'll be taking away with them to read on holiday. And this year, as with last, in spite of the fact that still no one is really going anywhere, we're asking the same question. Perhaps, in fact, the absence of actual travel makes the mental travels offered by books all the more essential and appealing. Joining us now to talk through this summer books feature is Alice Wadsworth. Hello, Alice. How are you?
Hello, Thea. I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am all right, thank you. Having read this feature now, do you have a reading list as long as both arms put together?
Yes. It was already as long as that, so now it's all the rest of my limbs as well, and then some.
Oh, dear.
Good, though.
Yeah. It's a good list to have.
Thing to do is go to an independent bookshop and buy those books.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Now I have many to go to, thanks to your recommendation.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you see, it's all joined up thinking here. So, Alice, why don't you start us off then? Whose metaphorical suitcase do you have your eye on?
Well, I was really interested in Barbara J. King's metaphorical suitcase. Straight from the beginning, because The Secret Social Lives of Reptiles sounds absolutely brilliant, a non-fiction book on kind of science writing about family lives in turtles, snakes and crocodilians, which looks quite interesting in the way that, you know, how a lot of people looked into with octopuses recently and squid and seeing a lot more intelligence in those areas that we didn't see before. That seems to be also what's happening with J. Sean Doody and Vladimir Donets's book here.
And I suppose also because we tend to, I mean, to generalize massively here, people tend to be less, you know, gooey about reptiles than they do about nice fluffy mammals. So I wonder whether we don't sort of, maybe they get a bit of a raw deal out of that. We don't really think of them as you know, lovely sociable creatures.
They really do. I mean, maybe it's the way they blink.
Maybe it is the way they blink.
Or the fact that Komodo dragons can both poison you with their bite and kill you with the fact that they're just giant old dinosaurs which are filled with muscle. But I'm quite obsessed with reptiles, and it's become quite a big thing with a lot of people following Instagram accounts of different reptiles. That's become really? Quite a strange lockdown trend that I've definitely got involved in.
I suppose if people are around their houses a lot more and they have reptiles in tanks or whatever it is that you keep reptiles in, then they will simply be observing them more. So I can see that they would become even more interested in something that they were interested in already.
And they are surprisingly cute when they're being fed bugs and things.
So cute.
But I think you're right though, Alice. Everyone thought octopuses and squid were just weird things. And it turns out octopuses are totally brilliant.
Geniuses.
And I'm one of, everyone watched My Octopus Teacher. It was incredibly moving. She basically gave him a hug. I was in bits, frankly.
Yeah, and then when his son carries it on, the little baby octopuses. Yeah, it's beautiful. And I think it's something I've always found quite interesting, how we have started off thinking that intelligence is such a preserve of just humans, and that human intelligence is this best, most rational type of intelligence. And it's made us fail to recognize a lot of really interesting ways of thinking different animals until we actually got around to observing them properly.
Exactly, which is probably why the reason that we have become more culturally attached to certain animals, like I said, the kind of the cuter, fluffier mammals, is because we have a clearer kind of identification with them, whereas we wouldn't like to identify ourselves so much with reptiles, maybe.
Yeah, the ultimate other. Another interesting bit I just saw from Secret Social Lives of Reptiles that's fun is they can communicate with each other while still in the egg.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's advanced. Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, that does sound like a very worthwhile recommendation.
You'll have to read it, Alice, and then come back in the autumn and just tell us all about the Secret Social Life of Reptiles.
Yeah, or we could have a kind of a reptilian fact every week.
I would love that. That would be brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, that's that sorted then. Lucy, why don't you give us something from your whose suitcase you've been admiring? Yeah.
I think I would like to steal Mary Norris's bag, because she wants to read a book called Hearing Homer's Song: The Brief Life and Big Idea of Milman Parry. He's a classicist. Milman Parry was a classicist. Because there's a rather kind of, as she says, an academic noir story about how he died, sadly, very young. But he's called, I don't know anything about any of this, hadn't heard about it before at all. He's called the Darwin of Homeric Studies. Mm. And I don't know what the big idea is.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I want to know.
Very intriguing.
What the big idea is. He won a great big grant to write the book. So he's clearly, I've just seen it's from 1902, so it's not breaking news. Turns out it was a little while ago. But I would like to find out what the big idea is. And her other choice is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain by George Saunders, his recent one, which is about Russian literature. I don't really know anything about Russian literature either, but I've read a little bit about this book, and I would like to have a read of it. It comes highly recommended. I'd also like to read Lincoln and the Bardo, which I didn't manage to do, weirdly.
I did, and I really enjoyed it, especially the first part. I thought I think it sort of petered out a little bit for me, but I loved the first part, which is set in the cemetery with this kind of choral element to it.
Whose bag are you going to nick?
Well, I think my first choice, and I'm going to come back to Alice and Lucy again, because I think we have two hands, so we get two suitcases each. But my first suitcase would be Andrew Motion's, I think. He mentions this book called Out of the Cage by Carol Jacoby. And he says it's several books in one. It's subtitled The Art of Isabel Rawthorne, who lived between 1912 and 1992. He says his main achievement is to do justice to this compelling but neglected artist. And I've never heard of her, which is no mean feat, he says, given that a good deal of her work has either gone missing or is held in collections unseen by the general public. So I don't feel too bad about not knowing about her. But the book, he says, also gives a wonderfully lively picture of the mid-20th century European art scene and a differently engrossing sense of Rawthorne's personal life, mapping onto, among other things, her relationships with Epstein, Giacometti, Constant Lambert,
Alan Rawthorne and Francis Bacon. So what he means, I suppose, by it being several books in one is that it's both, you know, biography and also, he says, a major contribution to the history of recent painting and the circumstances in which it evolved. So he says clever and fascinating and necessary, and it sounds like all of those things. But yes, one more bag each, I reckon. So Alice, who else's will you take?
I would love to take Lamorna Ash's bag. Again, another delicious nonfiction book. This one is The A to Z of Pasta.
Differently delicious.
Yeah, differently delicious than The Reptiles. Over 120 essential pasta and sauce recipes. I didn't exhaust pasta during lockdown, and good pasta feels like a holiday thing for me. Haven't been anywhere, and
you can't exhaust pasta.
Yeah, so that sounds like an absolute dream to read. And then they've also added Akawehia Mezi's Dear Senthurin on Faber, which is their first work of nonfiction, which is a memoir about their unfolding sense of self, which I think should be really interesting. I'm really excited to read that.
Yes, I've heard positive noises about that one too. And Lucy, one more for you.
Am I allowed one more? That's good.
One more bag, not one more book. You're allowed to do what Alice sneakily did there and bring in a couple.
Okay. I kind of only, I will read the other one. I'm sure it's interesting, but I want this for, I want Muriel Zaga's bag because it wants to read Laurent Binet's Civilizations. Actually, she's French, so she'll probably read it in French, but it's been translated now. Great big counterfactual novel. The Vikings discover America. Columbus's expedition fails, she says, and the Incas conquer a bewildering new world, Europe. And I love everything of Laurent Binet's that I've read before. And this sounds completely different.
It sounds very, very rich, doesn't it?
Yes, it sounds amazing. I fear that I might not know enough history to know how counterfactual it is. I'll just go, oh, is that what happened?
That's a fact.
Yes. Well, so I'll have to keep it in my mind that it is counterfactual. She's also got in her bag Kubrick's Napoleon, the greatest movie never made. But I don't. I want another Napoleon book. Can I half inch another Napoleon book?
You can, but before you do, just tell us briefly about this this Kubrick one, because it sounds fascinating.
It does. It does sound fascinating. No, you're absolutely right. So it's a record. Actually, having said that, maybe I'll just keep this book because it does sound really interesting. A record of Stanley Kubrick's single-minded fascination and identification with Napoleon's legend. So he was going to make a film about Napoleon. It might have starred Jack Nicholson as the emperor, which is kind of feels a bit counterintuitive, but okay. And Charlotte Rampling as Josephine. And then when MGM pulled out at the last minute, Kubrick went on instead to make A Clockwork Orange. So,
gosh, I can't believe they pulled out.
That's the sort of counterfactual.
How was it never picked up again?
That would have been a hell of a film, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Kubrick's
yeah.
Napoleon. Okay, Thea, what's your bag for your other hand?
Well, I'm going to use my other hand to point at a bag, but I'm not going to pick it up. But I would like to point to Claire Loudon's because I have these books already, so I don't want to pick it up and waste my energy in that sense. But I'd like to point to it because it resonates with me, as I suspect it will with others who turned back to George Eliot after the kind of nudge of her bicentenary of her birth in late 2019. So Claire Loudon is rereading Middlemarch, which I did last year. And she says, when I was 18, exactly half a lifetime ago, she read it for the first time then. She read it in hungry, dizzying gulps. Nearly perfect, I remember thinking. Shame about the preposterous initial conceit. In what universe would beautiful young Dorothea ever fall for crusty old Casaubon? What a pleasure, she says, to return to it at last this summer, though this time I'm taking slower sips. I'm only a few chapters in, but already I'm sober to find that Dorothea's misplaced passion now seems all too plausible. And I suppose it's just that thing, you know, that interesting thing that we've discussed a lot on this podcast about how a book can change utterly as you grow and as a reader and as a person. And it chimes again with something that BJ Silcox brings up in her contribution. She's writing about how she's unpacking all of these boxes of books that have been in storage for years. And she says, the boxes are a time capsule. There are old versions of myself stored among them too, and I'll reacquaint myself with these ghost girls. So yes, I'm pointing to two, but not picking them up.
It is, and luckily Middlemarch, I've only reread it once, as it were. And there's whenever you reread, there's a slight thing where you think, I hope it's as good as I remember.
Yeah, there's a fear, isn't there?
Yeah, and there was no, after about two sentences, it's just like, oh, great. I'm only at the beginning and I've got the whole thing.
Exactly.
And yeah, the second time I read it, I thought about it very differently, I think.
Let's turn to our own reading then now. Let's go with you, Alice, first.
Well, I just start with one that kind of set me off on it. I started reading Care Work for the second time, which is about disability justice and came out quite a few years ago by Lakshmi Piepsna Samara Senior. And it's looking at networks of mutual aid and care. And that led me on to a more recent one, which is Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good by Adrienne Marie Brown, which is a continuation. Well, it's not a continuation. It builds on disability activism and activism of self-care around communities of care, and also uses a bit of prison abolition philosophy and the Black feminist tradition, and it helps us rethink the ground rules of activism. I suppose a lot of people think that maybe activism or even volunteering isn't something that's necessarily pleasurable, enjoyable. It's more a duty, and Adrienne Marie Brown kind of shows how politics can feel good and how what feels good also has a complex politics of its own. And I thought that works quite well in conversation with care work as well.
It does. That sounds very interesting. Makes me think of a line in Eugene Grace Wirtz's contribution, where she says, fiction has been difficult to read during the pandemic, perhaps because our current times so surpass imagination. I found the exact opposite. I've lent much more deeply into fiction, I think. But what you seem to be suggesting with that choice there, Alice, is that perhaps you found yourself leaning more towards nonfiction and maybe books that encourage you to act, to do something.
Yeah, I think I'd been reading a lot of fiction, in particular short fiction, which I'm always enjoying reading. But yeah, with a lot of the things that have come up over lockdown and a lot of the discussions everyone's been having, I think with summer reading, that's when I feel I can really take time to spend a proper long amount of time on a set of nonfiction books that I can really have a conversation with. And so, yeah, I wanted to get more in depth behind a lot of the things I've been thinking about.
Concentrate. That sounds great. Well done. Lucy, tell us what you're going to be reading.
I find it a bit difficult to predict because in lockdown, I don't know if I've gone either way, but I seem to become even more scattergunned. So I read, you know, one new thing and then something that I've read 15 times before and then a bit of nonfiction. I'm not sure if there is a pattern. The only pattern is that there is even less pattern than usual, which is actually really good because I've read a lot of things I wouldn't have otherwise, and old and new, actually. I read War and Peace, for instance. It's really good.
It's quite good.
I don't know if you've heard of it. Wow, it turns out. But I don't mean, I'm not showing off to say, oh, look at this great big book I read, but I just sort of hadn't before, and it was there.
And it had always been there.
And so I just, you know, and I've read lots of other stuff as well, lots of, I don't know, you know, science fiction and nonfiction. But actually what I would like to, they're both TLS contributors, which this just sounds like an absolute stitch-up job, this. This is basically based on Sudhir Hazari Singh's bag. I would like to read his book about Toussaint Louverture, which I should have read already. I wanted to read and I haven't yet. And I would like to read that. Just won the Wilson History Prize. So hooray for that.
That's Black Spartacus,
yes,
isn't
yeah,
it?
I would love to read that. And I'd also like to read the book that he recommends by Ruth Skerr, our own Ruth, Napoleon, A Life in Gardens and Shadows. Not least because it's got gardens in it. Gardens and Napoleon.
Well, no one could do those two things and when they align. Even more so. I think that's fair. You're allowed both of those.
Thank you very much. What about you?
Well, actually, I'm going to nod back to a book that one of our contributors has flagged as well. Lucasta Miller mentions it. It's the biography of W.G. Sebald, Speak Silence in Search of W.G. Sebald. So it's by Carol Angier. And that's published in August. So, I mean, it's the first biography of Sebald, which seems... To me, it seems quite odd given the heft of his legacy, especially in our days of, you know, genre-bending, memoir-inflected writing. I just don't think anyone for me has come close to articulating and giving literary expression to you know, the pleasure and pain of emigration and chosen exile and cultural isolation and all of those things. Yes, yeah, so that. And in the meantime, I'm still deep in Henry Green.
Do you like it?
I do. I mean, Loving, which was the one that was published in 1945 about servants sort of trapped in an Irish country house during the Second World War, was brilliant. It had one of the best final lines I've read in any novel ever. And I'm almost through Living, which is the one that's set in the Forges of Birmingham. It's kind of famous for its language. He left out all the conjunctives to kind of mimic the accent. There's also a weird recurring motif of dead birds, oddly. Peacocks in Loving and poor pigeons in Living. So I look forward to seeing if this continues in the next book of his, which I'm going to read, which is Party Going.
Albatrosses, probably. I can't remember. No doubt there are birds in it.
Right. I think I'll probably just have to read Party Going, because for all I know, an albatross could be the bird that gets it there. But there we go. That was our three-woman bid to kickstart the economy and get everyone spending money on good things in good places. Alice, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure, as always. And that is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go also to Benjamin Schneider. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.